Hello and welcome to this podcast summary of the IASB board meeting on the 15th and 16th of November 2011. My name is Mark Byatt. I'm joined by Steve Cooper, member of the IASB, and Alan Teixeira, Director of Senior Director of Technical Activities. Hello, gentlemen.
Hello.
Right, let's kick off. Alan, perhaps you could talk about IFRS 9.
Right, thanks, Mark. There are probably two significant things that we had a look at this week with IFRS 9. The first was looking at the effective date or mandatory effective date of IFRS 9. There had been a proposal that the board had put out to push that back 2 years, so the mandatory date would become 1 January 2015 rather than 2013. The motivation for that was to make sure that the board had an opportunity to bring together the remaining chapters, because at the moment we've got chapters in place for classification and measurement and for derecognition, but we're still working on impairment and the hedge accounting sides of it. Now, the board agreed to put the date back until 2015. Perhaps as significant, though, was a decision related to that, is that because we've now have this opportunity, 2015, plus we're getting a lot closer, we think, on our insurance project. Now, the board's actually decided that they should consider making some limited improvements to IFRS 9, have a look at the interaction of the insurance contracts project, and it also gives them a chance to reflect and review the classification and measurement model. We know a lot, some jurisdictions, some companies have started applying IFRS 9, and in jurisdictions, even if they haven't adopted IFRS 9, a lot of companies are doing a lot of work in preparation for it, and they've learned a lot from that. So the board's quite conscious that this is a very tricky balance, because they don't want to make significant changes to it. The idea is to look at making changes, if they do, as soon as possible, and to really limit the scope of those to minimise any potential disruption of those who've already applied it or are close to applying it. The other thing it does do is it gives us an opportunity as well. The FASB, as people will know, developed their financial instruments project in parallel with us. And they're getting closer. They've moved away from a full fair value model into a model that includes amortized cost, mixed attribute model. And this is an opportunity to see if there are places where we can actually bridge or remove some differences between IFRS 9 and what could potentially become the US GAAP requirements. So it's just a decision to look at that. As I said, we are not looking at making wholesale changes, but to look to see whether in applying it with particular instruments, people have believed that an instrument that they think they're being forced to measure at fair value perhaps could be, if we tidy up the wording, could get that into one category or the other, make it much clearer, for example. One other little bit related to this, having put back the effective date to 2015, we had built into IFRS 9 some disclosure requirements on transition, included some concessions for those people who adopted it early. What the board has done is they've essentially retained those concessions but made them available more widely than they were before. So we had to have a look at those. We also think that what we've done is simplified. So rather than requiring a whole lot of comparative disclosures, there's basically a package of disclosure requirements that's kind of like almost a little bit like pro formas that I think help provide the effect of what the new standard will have. So I just encourage people that should be out as a package a little bit around about a month or so from now.
Okay, provides a neat link into insurance. Steve, perhaps you could talk about the discussions on insurance.
Yes, well, we had two sessions on insurance. The first was to discuss again the treatment of the residual margin, and this is the so-called locking unlocking decision. The exposure draft required that the residual margin be locked, and that's to say that it is run off over the period of the contract, and that any changes in estimates, changes in assumptions would flow through the income statement. The board previously took a tentative decision to unlock the residual margin, and that is that rather than changes assumptions go through the income statement, they're offset against any remaining balance in respect to the unallocated residual margin. There are advantages and disadvantages of this, but more particularly, we didn't fully discuss exactly how that would work and what changes would flow through the residual margin. There are changes to assumptions, there's experience adjustments, there's changes to discount rate, changes to lapse assumptions, for example. And clearly, if we are going to unlock the residual margin, then we have to be much more specific about exactly how that is operated. So we had a further discussion on that. It was an education session. We didn't make any decisions at the meeting, and we will further consider those deliberations going forward. So it's too early to say exactly what the final outcome will be on that. The other discussion we had, and this was jointly with the FASB, was about disaggregation and unbundling, which are related terms, and in particular applying the separation either through unbundling or disaggregation to investment components of insurance contracts. So this is where an insurance contract has an investment feature, a deposit component, a link to underlying assets, but also a significant transfer of insurance risk at the same time, so it qualifies as an insurance contract. And there are a number of different ways one can deal with this. Unbundling, which means separate measurement of the components, the investment component being measured as a financial instrument under a different standard, the insurance component measured under the insurance contract standard. Or you could measure the whole contract in the same way, using the measurement methodology of insurance, the building block approach, and then you could disaggregate this for presentation purposes and separate the components either or both in the balance sheet and the statement of comprehensive income. So we had a lengthy discussion on this. It was complicated by the fact that we have these two alternatives of unbundling and disaggregation, further complicated by there being many, many different types of contracts out there, also complicated because it interacts with what we're working on in terms of presentation. And we certainly haven't reached the end of our discussions in any of those areas. So whilst there were some indicative votes that were taken to get people's ideas on this, I don't think anything yet has been finalised. And there are a number of issues that we do need to still address. So this is very much ongoing work.
Alan, perhaps you could talk a little bit about the discussion on leasing.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. It's fairly small issues this month because, as I think people are aware, we're coming quite close to the end of the deliberation process for this. The main area was on a couple of consequential amendments and transition. First one was in business combinations where, let's say that you basically have merger and acquisition or buy another company and it's got existing leases. What do you do with those things? The existing requirements in IFRS 3 for us today mean that if you've got what we call a capital lease, you keep that lease classification, but you measure the asset and related liability each at fair value. If you've got an operating lease, using our terminology today, you don't recognise a separate asset or liability, but you do recognise if it's off-market, essentially. Now, what they've decided is that with the broadening of the definition of a lease, both boards have agreed that we should change that requirement for a BizCom. And instead, what you would do is, if you're a lessee, you're going to recognise a liability to make the lease payments and a right-of-use asset, and you measure those at the present value of the lease, future lease payment. So rather than at fair value, you link it back into the cash flow still to make. Same for your lessor, and you're applying the receivable residual approach. You recognise a right to receive lease payments and a residual asset. And essentially, again, you use the present value of the lease payments to do that. The slight complication there is that we have this residual asset in there, and you measure that as the difference between the fair value of the underlying asset. So I'm leasing an aircraft out to somebody, you fair value that, and you compare that fair value with the present value of the future lease payments, that gives you your residual asset. Again, we have to deal with the investment properties. They simply stay within existing IFRS 3 for the US, that's in their same business combinations requirements. The board's also had a look at one concession, and that is, it might have a 10-year lease, but it's only got 6 months to run, for example. Essentially, we're not going to make people record a separate asset and liability for that. That's basically, gives them a short-term concession. Speaking of those, the other thing too is that under the existing requirements in IFRS 3, you might have an off-market lease, and so you've got a net asset or liability recognised in the books. Well, rather than allow people to carry those on, essentially we're going to tell people on transition to the new requirements to bring into play the asset and liability. So they it puts them on the same, exactly the same footing as if they set up their lease themselves. And our board, of course, looked at IFRS 1 first-time adoption, and it's going to make any concession or transitional relief that's available now to those who are already applying IFRS will be available to first-time adopters.
Okay. Perhaps we could return to financial instruments. Steve, do you want to talk about the discussion on macro hedging?
Thanks, Mark. The discussions are continuing. Difficult subject, but we're certainly making some progress in this area, better understanding of what the issues are and moving forward, I hope, towards a satisfactory answer. The session was more educational. We did have one tentative decision, which I think moves us forward, and the staff outlined some of the issues that they're going to consider in further developing a model, which I think indicates some good progress in this area. The decision we took was about how the model would work. And essentially, there are two things. In order to avoid the accounting mismatch that you would get without applying hedge accounting, you've either got to adjust the hedging instrument measurement, or you've got to adjust the measurement of the hedged item and in some way reflect an adjustment in the financial statements for that. Adjusting the hedging instrument would mean measuring derivatives involved in macro hedging at other than fair value, and the board did not believe that that was the right way forward, that derivatives should continue to be measured at fair value, the only logical measurement basis for these instruments, and that any application of hedge accounting would therefore require a separate identification of the value of the risk position and the value changes of that risk position. Now, exactly how that is identified and then how it's presented, whether it's a separate asset or liability position in the balance sheet or whether there's an adjustment through OCI, the board hasn't yet decided, and we've still got some way to go before we can get to actually working out exactly how the macro hedge accounting model will work. So, ongoing discussions.
Okay, well, let's stick with the financial instruments for a little longer. Alan, can you talk about the discussion on offsetting?
Yeah, what we did is finalised a couple of things. As people are aware, we're trying to get comparability between US and GAAP and IFRS financial statements, and the boards didn't reach a converged solution on that. So what they've decided to do is to put in place some disclosure requirements that will allow people to reconcile between the two. And essentially, for us, that's a set of disclosure requirements that will change IFRS 7, which is our financial instruments risk-related disclosure standard. The board confirmed those, and they confirmed the effective date would be 1 January 2013. So that will be, we expect to get that out towards the end of this year, so it's not very far away. Related to that, though, is that during our outreach, we discovered that there were, in some cases, people weren't thought about IAS 32 in slightly different ways, and we're clarifying that. So there's a clarification essentially to do with the right of offset, that not only does it have to be legally enforceable in the normal course of business, but it has to be enforceable in the event of default or insolvency or bankruptcy. And that clarification or new application guidance will be the mandatory date is 1 January 2014.
Okay. Let's stay with you, Alan. If you could talk a little bit about the discussions on the annual improvements process.
Yeah, on the first day of the meeting, we have a few annual improvements to have a look at. Essentially, our process for that is that these are hopefully non-controversial areas, but they're areas where we think we can make a small change and improve or clarify the requirements. The board itself doesn't do the work on these. The board asks the Interpretations Committee to do most of the heavy lifting on this. They help us identify whether it is in fact something that is worth clarifying. They'll make some recommendations, so the board discusses them, but is guided by the Interpretations Committee. So we had a look at clarifying. One I think was particularly helpful. It came from a regulator who thought it would be helpful if we amended IFRS 8, our operating segment standard, because by adding a new disclosure requirement, they thought it would help them be able to be enforced more consistently. So I think that's an opportunity to help the enforcers as well. We had a look at classification of interest that's paid and that's capitalised, and where in the statement of cash flows you disclose that, and also some had a look at IAS 24 about what key management personnel really are. So essentially, those will come out. Some in the package actually next year, so it's a little bit slow. It's just the way it is. We have an annual cycle, but there are just some small improvements.
Okay. Thank you. What's coming up?
Well, coming up in the next couple of weeks, there's an IFRS conference in Melbourne on Friday next week, and that's been well attended by IFRS people. I believe there are just over 200 participants, people have registered to go to see that. And the 2 days before that is a meeting of the AOSSG, that's the ASEAN OSEAN Standard Setter Group. It's an important group, it representatives from Japan and China and New Zealand and Australia, Hong Kong, for example. So they'll all be meeting in Melbourne for 2 days in public with ISB representatives there.
Okay. Alan, Steve, thank you very much. That just leaves me to provide the obligatory disclaimer. These are the personal views of the presenters and may not necessarily represent those of the IASB. The official summary of the meeting is provided by IASB Update, which is available to download from the IASB website. Thank you.